Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lowell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. My guest tonight is Adrian Galish, and I've known him for a long time, and we've never got a chance to get him on the show, but finally, I was able to get him here. And it's great to have him on. I met him, I think it's a couple of years ago. I met you through J.P. Durand.
Yep.
We did a jam over at a studio, and we were testing out all these different amps. And if you go to the Flow Guitar Facebook page under the photos and look up the album J.P.'s Amp Cave, you'll see all of the what happened there, and also you'll see Adrian there. And he brought this really interesting guitar at the time, which he brought in today, and we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. But it was custom made for him, his own signature model, and it's a really interesting guitar. I got to play it, and it was a lot of fun, and it really sounds great. Adrian came out with a new album called Into the Blue, and as we were talking before the show, it started out as a blues album, but kind of went a little...
Well, that was the big idea. My last album was a record called Tone Poet, and for me, that was going to be my magnum opus. That was, you know, I come from a background of listening to 70s-era guitarists like Uli John Roth, Steve Howe, Robin Trower, guys like that. And eventually, you know, getting a little bit older, started listening to Steve Vai and all the guys from the 80s, and that is sort of my prog rock opus. You know, it's got everything from choirs and string sections. It's got Todd Zuckerman from Styx on drums and Philip Bino from Steve Vai's band on bass. And just, it was a lot of work. Some of the songs had upwards of 60 plus, you know, tracks of instruments.
Oh, wow.
And to really manage that, being self-produced, and then, you know, mixing it and making sure everything kind of has its little space, you know, on the record, was a lot of work. And doing interviews such as like we're doing now, inevitably, whoever I was talking to would go, well, hey, this is a great album. What's next? And of course, I'm like, what the hell do you mean, what's next? I just spent 2 years putting together what I think is the greatest thing I've ever worked on, and you're asking me what's next. But eventually I had to answer that question, and over time, you know, as the album, you know, was released, and then you kind of go through a few months of doing, you know, press and some performing and stuff, eventually you kind of feel like recording a new album. And I would say that it was a daunting idea to kind of do that again, meaning, you know, do a big production, you know, album like that. And I thought to myself, well, you know, how do I still be me, but... you know, not have to work so hard. And I thought, well, hell, everything, you know, every guitarist learned the blues, you know, growing up. From when you learn your first pentatonic scale and your first, you know, 12-bar blues, you know, that was sort of in your wheelhouse, at least for me and a lot of my friends growing up, you know, playing guitar. And I thought, well, I should do a blues record. I've been singing some blues, you know, classic blues tunes live, you know, for the last 6-7 years. And I thought, well, I could start there and try to write some stuff and do some, you know, blues covers. And that sounded great because, well, all I need is drums, bass, guitar, maybe keyboards and vocals. And I don't have to put in the string section and the choir and all that other mm-hmm. stuff. And so that was the big idea. So going into it, there was a handful of songs that are on the record, like Messing with the Kid, No One Knows You When You're Down and Out, and Further On Up the Road that I had been doing live all the time. And I'm like, well, I'm going to start there. Those are the tunes I'll you know, start off with. And then I'm going to start, you know, writing and recording and stuff. Did it turn into a classic blues record, you know, like a Muddy Waters, you know, album? No, not really. So when I sat down to actually, you know, compose and write, I'm still me. You know, I still draw from, you know, classic rock, 80s rock, stuff like that. So I think, you know, when I think of blues, I think of everything from Muddy Waters and, you know, Robert Johnson. But I also think of Jimmy Page. I think of Joe Bonamassa. I think of, you know, Larry Carlton, Robin Ford, and even Carl Verheyen and guys like that. There's a lot of different kinds of blues out there. I knew that no matter what I did, you know, I would sound like me. You know, even if it was me holding me back and not playing a million notes and, you know, getting a more authentic blues tone, the phrases are still going to be me. It's still going to be my fingers and, you know, that sound. So I wasn't worried about that, but it was a big question mark as to how this album was going to end up sounding. So what you have in your hands there is, yeah, a handful of classic blues tunes that I've kind of, you know, given a modern approach to. And then the songs that I wrote kind of draw more from just a 70s blues rock feel. To me, it's a bit of Hendrix, a bit of Robin Trower, a bit of Clapton, a bit of Jimmy Page, and it's sort of my version of all of that.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of you have the blues roots. It's obvious that, and I'm going to play a clip real quick in a second to kind of show that. But the thing is, a lot of guitarists that do like the 80s, what I call keyboard guitar, where they do a lot of arpeggios yeah. and they do something, it's cool. I mean, I love it. But they never had that feel, the blues feel. Whereas your Jimmy Page, your Clapton, the Stones, they're obviously rooted in that blues
yeah,
feel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great to hear the pyrotechnics and stuff, but they didn't, you know, the blues had that feel.
Mm-hmm.
But I hear you doing the blues, and it has that feel, but you'll like throw in this thing that's very prog-ish, and it's like, oh wow, okay, that's kind of cool.
I can't help myself.
You're just it's integrated in your blood. But let me play a clip.
Okay.
I was going to open up with Let Your Hammer Ring Out, but since you mentioned that, I'm going to start out with Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out, because you said that's a pretty you play that as a standard, and it kind of shows your blues playing.
So, you know, before you even press play, you know, I had heard this song from another guitar teacher when I was teaching at the National Guitar Workshop like maybe 7-8 years ago. And I was like, man, that's an amazing tune. Who does it? He goes, well, you got to check out Clapton with Derek and the Dominoes. They do a cover of this song. It's an old, you know, standard. So I went and I got that. And I go, man, the song's great, but this recording is kind of lame. Now I'm going to get a lot of flack for saying Derek and the Dominoes with Eric Clapton might be lame. But their version is kind of repetitive and dynamics-wise really, to me, wasn't delivering the full potential of the tune. So I set out to do what I thought could be a definitive version of the song. So you'll hear, I don't know how much you're going to play, but it's very dynamic. There's lots of ups and downs in the overall dynamics of the tune.
Okay, well, I'm pulling the clip where you go into the lead.
We could do that, yeah.
So here's Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out.
Thank you.
So you can hear a little bit at the end. You start doing those little arpeggiated.
Got a little Yngwie on you there.
Yeah, but it's now that's interesting. Now you're using the Moore guitar, right? On that, or what are you using?
I am not. So an interesting story with the whole record is right before I started writing and recording and demoing, which really is almost all the same thing for me. So when I start to kind of demo and write a song, I'm doing it with the computer. I've got a keyboard where I'm, you know, doing like electronic drums, and I start to kind of assemble parts. Hey, here's a verse. Here's a potential chorus. And then I can cut and paste and, you know, put it in the order that I want to arrange for the song. And eventually, a lot of the parts get replaced. I'll take live drums, replace, you know, guitar parts, vocal demo stuff. And it eventually just evolves into the final product. So about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I bought on an auction a 69, maybe a 70 Strat. And it was all original, big headstock, three-way switch, still the original frets, which were worn to a nub. And the idea was that, man, I got such a good deal on this guitar, I'm going to turn it around, stick it on eBay, and, you know, try to make some money. And I did that for a while, but nobody was buying. And I got to imagine, one, I don't have the right connections in the vintage world. Two, nobody's going to lay down $10,000 on eBay sight unseen. And the price kept getting lower, and I kept having this guitar just sitting there, occupying, much to my wife's dismay, a whole bunch of credit card space on my credit card. Mm-hmm. But the guitar was in my studio, just sort of sitting there all this time. So I put fresh strings on it, had it set up. And then every time I sat down to record and demo stuff, I grabbed this 69 Strat. And two things happen. One, it gets the Hendrix era tone. The front pickup next to the bridge just quacks like you wouldn't believe. The neck pickup has that huge Hendrix-y, Foxy Lady kind of tone. The middle pickup is completely useless. And but it gave you that right sound, and it just had so much vibe. The guitar was kind of beat up, a sunburst Fender with a rosewood fingerboard. And the guitar also made me work for it. It didn't have like jumbo frets or anything. So literally bends and all the runs, you just really had to be on top of what you were doing. You couldn't get away with a lot of fast sweeping and technical stuff. The guitar just wasn't built for that, either back then or the fact that it just had these tiny little nubs of frets. And I started recording almost everything. All these songs probably have that guitar on it in one shape or another, because it just sounded great. And so what you heard there was the demo take for that solo. And it's one of those things where, man, I kept living with it, thinking I was going to replace it at some point. And then I thought to myself, you know what, there's a flub here and there, but I think the vibe of the guitar solo worked. And to me, playing that song, I was really just, you know, worried about, one, not fretting out on this guitar, and two, kind of making the chord changes and working with that. But that guitar was really cool. I did eventually sell it to Joe Bonamassa.
I remember. Didn't you bring that down to the gun club?
I brought it to the gun club. I remember Joe walked in while we were eating dinner already, and he walked right by the table. I go, Joe. And he's like, yeah, how's it going? I go, my wife wants you to buy this guitar. That's what I said. And he goes, what do you got? And I unzipped the bag, and I go, it's a 69 Strat. And he looked at it. I showed him pictures of the neck and everything and the serial numbers. And then eventually I bugged him some more via email and went over to his rehearsal place. He took it apart, looked at the inside, and gave me some money for it. So it worked out. I was without a Strat at that point, and the album wasn't done. So a lot of stuff was completed with this Brian Moore guitar. I would say that probably 65% of the album was this Strat, and then the rest of it was this guitar, and then another Strat that I borrowed from Carl to finish some bits and pieces.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting. Now, I remember that guitar. I remember I actually tried it. It's a nice guitar.
It was a nice guitar. It was in pretty good shape for what it was, but it was completely all original. Nobody, if anything, it needed a refret, and it would have been beautiful. Joe says that he hasn't done a refret, but he put flat wounds on it, and like Ry Cooter now uses it for slide guitar,
oh, okay.
Which is a very bizarre thing.
Yeah, No, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm going to play another clip. I want to play what I was going to originally open with. And it shows you playing wah. And this is an edit. There's actually verses. And then I go to the leads. But I just pieced together the three leads. This is Let Your Hammer Ring. This is the opening song of the album. Mm-hmm. But I want to kind of show people your classic rock type of, because it, the licks are, though you throw in some prog things in there too. I mean, it's just inevitable. But I mean, I think that
there will inevitably be 16th notes on many of the songs.
But here, let me play this and you get an idea. And then we'll talk a little more about the amps and stuff that you use on there.
All right.
So here we go. So there you get a good mixture of like a classic wah lead, and then you're still doing some interesting little cool things.
The idea behind the tone was, it was wah-wah, and I had a MXR Phase 90, and I was like, what would a modern Robin Trower, you know, sound be? The initial rhythm tracks are the Strat that we talked about. This lead track was all my Brian Moore signature guitar. You'll hear that part is, I think, layers of both the Strat and then this guitar as well. So at a certain point, the Strat was gone, and I was starting to replace parts. So you'll hear a little bit.
What kind of wah were you using?
Morley Bad Horsey wah-wah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then let's talk a little bit about the amps you used on this album,
sure,
because you're getting a great sound out of it.
So if everybody in guitar land will sit down, no amplifiers were used on this record.
Oh, whoa. That's all plugins?
I think Billy in Illinois just had a heart attack. No. So the last album I did a little bit of tracking with the amps that I've got, and that's a mixture of everything from, you know, some PV tube heads to Marshalls and vintage Marshall stacks and things like that. And I'm recording at home, and if anybody's done this, you know, it usually looks like this. You've got cables running underneath your bedroom door into a bathroom where there's a half stack, and then, you know, nobody in the family can use the bathroom or the house for about, you know, 3 hours at a time. And you're lucky to maybe get the microphone just right, and everything's sounding pretty sweet. You get some takes, and then it turns out next week you want to kind of fix a part, but now you got to roll the amp back into the bathroom or lay down the cables and make it's a big pain in the butt.
Yeah.
And so I'm using Logic on a Mac, and it's Logic Pro 9, so it's like a six-year-old program now, and it's the regular plugins that came with the program. A lot of people ask this all the time, and it's almost, as a guitarist who's almost 42 years old, it's almost shameful for me to even admit that I'm not, you know, plugging into some cool amp, but it's literally running direct. And generally what happens is this. So for the tones to get big, earlier you asked about, you know, how I layer these sounds and make it so that the mix doesn't feel muddy and stuff. There's a few things that I would recommend. So one is, rhythm tracks are generally going to be doubled up. There's going to be a left speaker track, and then you're going to retake the guitar again on a right speaker. And a couple things you could always do to make that sound huge without, you know, occupying too much sonic space is I might have two different kinds of guitars. So I might have a Strat in the left, Les Paul in the right. Or I might do the bridge pickup on one take and maybe like an out of phase or neck pickup on the other take. Or I will literally do different amps. I'll do a British gain style, you know, Marshall on one side and then maybe an American style, you know, distortion on the other side. I can't remember all the stuff that I was doing, but I found a few tones. Most of them is like British gain 2. One of them was like, you know, hot rod 40 watt amp and you know, all their versions of what would be essentially like a matchless would be their hot rod boutique-y kind of amp sound. And then of course anything called British is a Marshall. And also the biggest misnomer and what I think a lot of younger people don't realize is that, you know, when you're tracking to get a big heavy tone, having the gain all the way up, you know, and then doubling that is just going to sound like a big buzzing, you know, sound, and it really doesn't do much. Metallica can somehow get away with it, but they're spending millions of dollars to get away with it. But think about it this way. The biggest, heaviest riffs are by, like, AC/DC, and the gain there is, like, maybe halfway up, you know. Or in their case, we're talking about, you know, an old JCM, you know, 800 or even older, you know, Marshall-type amp where they could crank it and crank it volume-wise to get it to break up. But it was never what we're hearing now with dual rectifier sounding distortions and stuff like that. So a lot of the tones, rhythm-wise at least, to let there be that huge sound but make space, you know, in the middle for either vocals or for a lead guitar, my gain setting is like maybe halfway up on mm-hmm. these things.
Well, it's interesting that you said that, because one of the things that I always found that an amp could do, and I never had a lot of success with a plug-in, was, like, for example, a Plexi Marshall without the master volume, like Humble Pie, Rockin' the Fillmore, he's turning it up, and it's moving the air, and it's compressed from the tube, but it's punchy. It's really punchy. And it's hard. Usually when I've used, like, a distortion device or an overdrive device, or though I've heard people like Steve Hunter, he's done some amazing stuff with plugins, and JP did it on mm-hmm. on some of the stuff that he's done. It's hard to get that punch, which is physically moving air.
Totally.
There's something about a 4x12 or two 4x12s cranked, and yeah. you're moving it. There is, with a good mic or three mics, like Led yeah. Zeppelin miking, you get that. You can feel it. It hits you in the chest.
I always describe it to people as the difference between the original Star Wars, where people were actually doing stunts with models and puppets, versus the newer Star Wars. It's all CGI'd.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's workarounds. One, my tone isn't going to be that. You know, it isn't literally the sound of me just, you know, blowing a Marshall, you know, 100-watt head from 1970, you know, as loud as I can to move as much air as I can. That isn't what I was going to mic up anyways. And then two is it's going to speak more with less gain. And then I always, when I send the tracks to get mixed, I don't send them bone dry. So usually as I'm working on a demo, I've got, you know, some reverb and some stuff tweaked out. And then I'll usually bring all that stuff almost all the way out. I think it's important that it still sounds like it was in a room, even if it wasn't. Right. So I usually leave a tad bit of usually the built-in reverb of the plugin. So it's a spring, you know, fake spring reverb or something. So instead of turning it all to zero and sending the guy, you know, bone dry stuff to mix, I tend to leave just a tiny little bit of ambiance in everything.
Right. Well, the tracks that you're setting up, even the ones with the extra processing in, are they mono, or do you send stereo, or do you send the effects, the reverb, separate as a separate track?
No.
You separate it?
Most of the tracks are mono, and so any kind of reverb that was there was built into the plugin in itself. It's part of the amp. It's the reverb right. on the amp. Now, oddly enough, what we just heard is the only track on here where there's a stereo lead guitar, and that was really done in the box as well. I mean, it's still it's a single lead going in, and then what I did is I had one track or one channel with one plug-in amp, and I just simply cut and pasted it into another channel the same signal, and then used a different amp. Mm-hmm. And then probably to make it even a little bit bigger, I'll take that second wave and I'll nudge it timing-wise by like a millisecond or two, just to give it some stereo separation and not, you know, not enough to be out of phase, but enough to kind of make your ears go, whoa, that's mm-hmm. huge.
Well, how do you get the punch in the sound? How do you, is that just the plug-in, or do you
it's
do anything?
Just
the,
there is nothing fancy.
And you're not doing any, I mean, like the Wah-Lee that we just played, that's a compressed,
that's my guitar.
Heavy, that's a heavy gain sound.
Yeah, that's which my is guitar normal. Into the Wah, and then plugged into whatever my M-Box is. And then into whatever that patch was, yeah, whatever that
right.
plug-in is.
But that's like a high gain sound, like in an amp. So it's kind of compressed in itself.
Yeah, yeah, true.
But the I think that I'm trying to think of what would be a good
if you want to hear the complete opposite of what we did would be. God, I have such a horrible memory. The leads for Unlovable Me.
Okay, let me play that clip.
This is that Strat on everything from the clean rhythm guitars as well as the leads. And it's more of a like vintage American tweed plug-in sound.
Okay, let's play Unlovable Me. This is an edit of all the
most people would swear this is some expensive vintage amplifier.
And this is the Strat, right?
Yeah.
This is the Strat. Okay, here we go. Get that kind of hollow sound that Strat has that when you get
I'm
that.
I'm telling you, every time I hear that solo, I wish I had that damn Strat.
And I don't blame you.
What you heard there was clipped together the intro solo and then the actual middle solo of the song. Each of those is just the take that I did on the demo. It was one of those things where I was like, man, I'm never going to get a better take than that. I'm just leaving it. And it's kind of neat. You might have thought you heard maybe a punch here and there, but that's the sound of me switching from the front pickup to the neck pickup.
I mean, I cut. There's a whole – there's singing, through the whole thing. Yeah. So you'll hear those cuts. But the the tone is right on
it's
the money.
It's a cool tone, yeah.
No, and it's interesting how you got that because it has that punch. And what I call like when you get on an amp where you're just getting a little bit of distortion, you're playing lighter, and you get that bloom where it just kind of just gets some – harmonic content.
And you can hear how that, you know, on the playing, I think if you listen closely, that's what I meant by kind of that guitar made me work for it. You know, you'll hear I'm really there's not a lot of hammer-ons and pull-offs. You really had to pick through everything, and you know, there's just enough mild distortion to give me some sustain and really make that guitar speak.
Now, you had some interesting people on this album, too. Yeah. You had Carl and Carl Verheyen and Johnny Hyland. Is that
Hyland?
Hyland. Yeah. Let me play the I pulled together some of the leads from Messing with the Kid.
Okay.
And then take a listen and then tell me who's playing what.
And all right.
Because I know I've cut it. I've abbreviated it, so I don't remember in the context.
Everybody should
song.
Be guessing at home. There's two solos. Who
okay.
did which?
Here we go. Messing with the Kid. So I presume the first one was you.
The first one is me, yeah.
The second one's Carl?
Yeah.
And then the third and kind of fourth is you?
Third
the cleaner,
and fourth.
Where the drum's kind of by itself with the bass, and then you're kind of doing a little bit, very sparse type of stuff?
No, that's all Carl. So there's literally, so it's 12-bar blues, and two choruses each. So I took the first 24 measures, he took the after the splice.
Okay.
So I'm everything before the splice, and he's everything after.
After the splice.
Yeah.
Now, when he recorded, he did it at his place, or did he do it at your place?
He came into my house, and it was funny, because he's like, you know, what amps you got?
I'm like, well. I know, he's a big amp.
And I'm like, well, I've been using these plugins, and he's like, well. And I go, well, I do have, you know, I've got some tube amps and stuff, you know, gave him a list, and I think he brought something in his car. But he heard, and he goes, well, let's just use that. Now, oddly enough, so the first solo I believe I did on my other Brian Moore guitar. I've got a green one, and it's got some hot rails that gives me a pretty good single coil sound. And then he used a Les Paul. I think it's something stupid, like a 58 Sunburst or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And by stupid, I mean awesome. And there's nothing better than watching him do takes and record him, because really any of them will work, and it's kind of just him picking his favorite. What you heard was the last take. If you go to my website or you go to my YouTube channel, there's a thing where it's the Adrian Gollish Into the Blue documentary, and I've got all sorts of footage of all the sessions and stuff. And so you can see me recording him at my home studio, which is really a glorified bedroom with a bunch of stuff in it. And he's halfway through, which was probably the take.
Right.
And stupid me. You know, I've got my hand like over the mouse button, which is really just the stop start button. And I like hit it in the middle of the, like just not even on purpose. And I could tell. And then looking back at the video, I keep hearing, you know, his take. And I'm like, God, that would have been the one. Well, we get second best. It was still pretty good. So, and oddly enough, though, if you listen to those two takes back to back, I think it's the same modeling amp patch, but they do sound different, you know, my guitar and my hands versus his guitar and his hands.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't sound like a plug-in. It does sound...
No, it sounds like a pretty badass...
Yeah, it sounds like an amp. And I mean, I know, and the way you guys are playing, too, it has a lot to do with it, but I mean, still, I would have thought that was an amp.
I spent a lot of time looking and scrolling and trying out different ones and really messing with the EQ and the virtual mic positioning and all that sort of stuff. But I would say that, man, when I found three or four good sounding sounds, I certainly copied and pasted them and kind of made a mental note of when to use those again.
Now, I'm going to play another clip, and I want to talk, because this is totally different. You're doing some other stuff. You're doing some slide stuff on this. So I'm going to play this is Who Am I to Say, and then you can tell me what you're doing on this thing. Sure. So here we go. Now, I hear like a, I think it's 12-string slide in there. Nope, that's 6-string? That's 6. God, that, oh, you're doubling it then. You had to be doubling. You had to be doing something.
I am quadrupling it.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So it is a 6-string guitar. It's a Yamaha AX, who the heck knows what it is, steel string guitar, and it's tuned. I stole this from Jimmy Page. From low E on high is D-A-D-A-A-F-sharp. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's used that before. It's a very bluesy kind of sound, and that's kind of what inspired the riff of this tune that I've had for a long time, but had nowhere ever to use it because, heck, I've never written, you know, a hoedown blues tune, you know, for any of my other records. So you hear that doubled, that main riff. And so that's a, you know, acoustic guitar on the left, acoustic guitar on the right. But yeah, I wanted it to sound like a 12 string. I don't have a 12 string, so I took a capo to the 12th fret. And mm-hmm. since it's a cutaway acoustic, I was able to double what I did down, you know, in an open position, but just up an octave, and then I doubled that. So it actually kind of sounds, to me, more like a mandolin or something like that, but it does kind of give you the sound of a 12-string. So you're hearing two acoustics in regular open tuning, and then two doubling that with a capo at the 12th fret, and kind of doing that.
Okay, then the lead.
And then the lead.
There's two leads.
So I wanted to do a slide guitar solo, and I own slides. I've got two, but I really suck at slide guitar. And I tracked it with slide, and I'm like, God, this is just lame. My intonation sucks. This is not going to cut it. So I did fake slide guitar with using a Floyd Rose on one of my Brian Moores, and it ends up sounding kind of close. That kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what all that is. And it took a whole lot of effort for me to get stuff that sounded like real slide, you know. There's maybe a lick here and there where you can go, I think that's whammy bar, you know. But that was me faking it.
No, some of it sounded like slide, but then I'd hear you play something and it's like, no, he's picking that.
Some of it is and some of it isn't.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
It's two different takes. So you're hearing a middle part, which is starts off with slide bluesy guitar, and then the kick drum comes back in, and I go into more of a more regular blues type of playing.
And that's the Moore guitar? Or did
it's
you use
my green Brian Moore, which has...
okay, the single coil. Because it had
the single coils. Totally.
It had that single coil.
And you'll hear what sounds like two different guitars, but it's really the same. It's got a single coil in the neck, the hot rails, and then it has just a humbucker in the bridge, and that's what makes it sound so hugely different.
Yeah, because you can hear it in the... where I edited to the other lead. Yeah. It's a totally different character to it, which is good.
But even that second lead is the same guitar, and there's a part where it goes from that sound to clearly a humbucking sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's very cool. I mean, it's like, what? It's kind of, you know, it's good. If you get the album and listen to it, it's like, wow, that, it kind of, but wait a minute, that doesn't, you know...
And I haven't done the fake slide stuff in, like, years, because I didn't want to. I mean, telling you, the whole album was me thinking I was going to make an authentic blues record.
Right.
But, it, you know, I always tell people, I go, yeah, you tell God your plans and he's going to laugh. So, it ends up being what it is, and, you know, you kind of have to end up making what works, you know, work. So,
well... we're getting almost done. We got a few more minutes left, but I want to cover the guitar a little bit, this guitar. We had talked about it at the jam, but I'd like to go into more detail about how you had this guitar made, what you were looking for, and what you asked.
Sure.
And you have the two models. So.
Yeah. So Brian Moore Guitars has been around since, I think, the early 90s. I was aware of them when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And met them at a NAMM show in Nashville, probably in 97 or something like that. And a funny story, if anybody's, you know, wants to know about endorsements and things like that, they always want to know what you can do for them. You know, a lot of artists think, well, I'm going to tell them what they can do for me, and they know what they can do for you. They can get you a good deal on guitar. But it's really not, you know, that's not what it's about. So anyways, we're at this NAMM show in Nashville, and their booth is located across from the Gibson booth. I'll make this really quick. And they had this guy all weekend long playing, you know... sorry about that, but playing Cliffs of Dover. And anytime that they were trying to demo one of their guitars, this guy gets up and he does Cliffs of Dover all day long from 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., Cliffs of Dover. And it was like the volume wars across the aisle. He kept turning up and they kept turning up and they're like, oh my God, if I have to hear Cliffs of Dover one more time. And so anyways, I see this going on and I tell Pat Cummings, the owner of Brian Moore Guitars, I go, you know what, next time that guy plays, I know that song. And so just hand me a guitar. And so the guy starts playing and it's, you know, and I start playing, you know, up a half step instead of, I started playing. Anyways, I'm playing in G sharp. He's playing in G, and I'm like playing it note for note along with him. And it sounds like the worst cacophony of sound you've ever heard. And the guy halfway through his performance stopped playing, unplugged, put the guitar down. And I've been an endorsee ever since. So anyways, that was a while ago. I've been using their guitars. They're a small company out of New York. And they made for me this custom guitar. Most of their guitars have a lot of the same features. It has this quasi-arch top. The back has this input jack that kind of fits right behind your strap that most people would have slid the cable back there anyways. Here, they've already got it kind of set up there. And it's got all sorts of really cool curves to it. But anyways, they're like, Adrian, what's your dream guitar? Tell us what you want. And what I did was I told them, well, man, I love these spalted maple top guitars you've got. Except, can you make one with a satin finish? I don't want it to be glossy. I want, you know, that coffee table of a guitar. So this guitar has the Spalton maple top, gold hardware, Floyd Rose, two Seymour Duncans. It's a JB in the bridge and an Alnico 2 Pro in the neck. And besides that, it's a rosewood fingerboard, locking tuners, locking nuts, which is kind of redundant, but still... Now, the cool thing is the sheer variety of tones. I do a lot of session work and recording for other people, and it's nice to have a guitar live as well as, you know, in the studio that kind of does it all. So here, my position number one, which would be like your bridge pickup, is the Seymour Duncan humbucker. You go to the second position, and it splits it. So now it's just the single coil. Yeah. in the next position, instead of being anything useless, now it's the split single coil in the bridge and a single coil in the neck. So more of a Telecaster sound. Fourth position is the split neck. So now it's just the single coil in the neck. And then a humbucker in the fifth position at the neck. But that's not all. I then pull out the tone knob, and then it turns the front humbucker back on. So it's like the middle switch on a Les Paul. I've got both humbuckers on, and it gives me that sort of Jimmy Page sound. And if I go back just one position, back to position four, I'll call it, it's the single coil in the neck plus the humbucker in the bridge. You can hear a little bit of humming. So it gives me seven different tones out of this one guitar.
So the popping the that volume, that knob...
It really just turns the humbucker and the bridge on. Back on. Yeah,
always
yeah,
on whatever exactly. else you use.
Yeah, yeah.
That's exactly. very cool. And you get that tele... Yeah, that's a... You get all the different sounds. But the single coil, I mean, that's got a lot of top end for those...
Yeah, it's pretty bright.
Yeah, and it's unusual because that was always, to me, I've talked to pickup manufacturers on the show... And that's always, you know, the humbucker sounds great, but the single coil suffers, but that really yeah. works.
I mean, it's a mahogany body, but it's a pretty small body. It's a lightweight guitar.
Yeah, and and it's routed out a lot, too. You'll
yeah,
see the pictures.
And the maple, you know, top is spalted, so it's not horrifically bright. But I think what really makes it bright is just a lack of a finish on this thing.
Mm. So, yeah. And then the neck is maple with a rosewood?
Yeah.
And then anything special about the neck? What kind of frets? Anything major?
These are... they're like medium jumbos, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing crazy.
And then what kind of strings are you using and what gauge?
Sure. These are SIT strings is the brand. And these are their power steels. I use stainless steel strings. The reason is, for some reason, the pH in my skin, man, is so oily that if I use regular nickel strings, I'd probably tarnish them and they would go bad probably in a day or two. So this gives me a little bit more life. A lot of people say that, you know, well, the stainless steel is going to, you know, wear out the frets faster and, you know, it's a brittler sound, and they might be right, but I'm lazy and I don't want to
change
strings all
the time. Well, I noticed that with the stainless steel, the harmonics are different.
Probably a little bit.
But you, it doesn't seem to be any, you don't seem to have any problems, but I know.
They're all there. Yeah.
They're all, but I mean, I've noticed that with, I use nickel on my guitars and they, you know, I get a certain harmonic that I can get. And then I've tried the stainless steel and it was like totally different. I couldn't get it from the same.
Interesting.
Position.
Gotcha.
You know, and then what's the gauge?
These are extra lights, nines, whatever
nine,
that ends
show
up
you
being.
Have nines. Yeah. Okay, but that's yeah, that's great, and then you, it's clamped on both ends. Anything? What kind of tuning keys? Anything?
Good question.
These oh, are those are locking.
Spurzels, yeah,
they're spurzels.
Yeah.
So that's.
It's a really really solid guitar.
Now this okay, so you have this one and then you have the other one. What's the difference on the
so
other
so the
guitar?
Other one does have a finish. It's a regular maple top. It's got a JB humbucker and two hot rails, and the pickup selection works almost, oddly enough, since it's got three sets of pickups, it almost works the same, though. From the bridge, it's the humbucker. The next position splits that humbucker and gives me a single coil. The middle position gives me the single coil split from that humbucker and a single coil from the hot rail. So it's, again, sort of that teletone. The fourth position is a Strat sound. It's the neck hot rail split with the middle hot rail, one half of it,
mm-hmm.
giving me two single coils to get that skanky out of phase Strat sound. And then the last position would be just the full hot rail. Now, hot rails to me, even though they're humbucking, still have sort of a single coil Strat kind of tone because it's picking up sort of the same amount of magnetic space, I think. Mm-hmm. And then you pull the tone knob again on that other guitar, and it turns that humbucker from the bridge back on to anything else I had before.
So the same type of thing. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's another seven sounds.
Now, so the... Have you noticed that with the the hot rails, are they a little less output than this guitar, so that you get
less,
more tone?
No, they're pretty hot. They're hot rails.
Okay, because that's usually when you have more gain coming out of the pickup, you usually lose some tone.
You know, it's to my ears, it's just different. You know, it has, like I said, that more of a Fender Strat kind of thing coming out of it. Does it sound like a modern take on that? Yeah. Granted, it's also mahogany body, so it's you know.
No, that has the wood itself as a...
Yeah, totally doesn't have that, what you described as sort of that hollow, stratty, you know, kind of tone that the other guitar has.
Well, I told you it would go by real fast. We're already out of time. Now, before we go, I just want to mention, first of all, this is Into the Blue is the name of the album, and it's available everywhere, right?
Yep.
And also, if you guys are into the prog stuff like me, Tone Poet, which is available everywhere, too. And www.adriangalish.com. Uh-huh. You can check out all his stuff and the videos behind the scene. Very cool. I'm going to check that out myself. He also has a book called Progressive Guitar Warm-Ups and Exercises.
Yeah. Right? I've been teaching for about 23 years, and inevitably, you do something that long, you kind of start seeing the same problems, issues, and things that are keeping students, you know, from really reaching their potential technique-wise. And I put together a book of simply exercises for left and right hand, picking, coordination, things like that, that I found helped whatever the situation was. And it's called Progressive Guitar Warm-Ups and Exercises because it starts off really easy. If you only have like 5 minutes, you can, you know, maybe do the first two or three exercises. If you got more time, it starts getting into more intricate kind of techniques and things like that. And by, if you get to the end of the book, then we're talking about sweep picking exercises, string skipping exercises, things that are a little bit more advanced.
And then also, too, so check that out. But also, too, where are you playing so people can
hear you? If anybody's in the Los Angeles area, my next band gig is going to be at a place called Skinny's Lounge on August 14th. This is a Sunday night. It is free, so all you got to do is show up. Now, every Friday, I do a solo jazz performance at a place called the 94th Aero Squadron, which is right next to the Van Nuys Airport. Matter of fact, you get to watch me play guitar while there's planes taking off and landing right behind me through the windows. And it's a really cool old building, tons of vibe. And again, it's free. I play there from 6 to 9 o'clock every Friday. Don't come this week. I'm going to be visiting my parents on the East Coast. It's their 50th anniversary. If they're listening, happy anniversary. But I'll be back. I'm there literally every Friday. It's a ton of fun. And also, if you go to the website, adriangalish.com, you'll see a link there for a free 5-song EP download. Click on that. Granted, you're going to sign up for my email list, but I'm not going to sell it to anybody. I'm just going to let you know about more gigs and merch and stuff like that. But you do that, you get yourself 5 songs from each of my 5 albums, and no
very
charge,
cool.
man.
Very, yeah. very cool. Now, before, I told you we just scratched the surface, so definitely it just means you have to come back. I'm going to take us out, I'm going to play a clip called Why Am I Singing the Blues? So kind of set it up, and then we'll...
Sure. If somebody were to ask me what, like, the song on the album is, this is kind of the one. It's one of the first ones I wrote. I wrote most of the lyrics with Casey Clanton, the singer's help. To me, it's just really embodies my sense of composition, song arrangement, guitar playing, and it's me sort of trying to channel David Gilmour and Joe Bonamassa all in once. And it's a slow blues tune, but I hope you dig it.
Okay, everybody. Adrian, thank you again. I'm glad I was able to have you on the show, finally.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun.
It's a ton of fun, and I will be seeing you at the gun club meetings.
Yep.
But everybody, have a great week, and this is Why Am I Singing the Blues?